May it please the court. Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice, other members of the court. Good afternoon, Judge Nicholas. My name is Kevin Howard. I'm here representing Troy McNally, the appellant in this matter. This is the second argument on his appeal of his conviction of last, I believe it was January, of four counts of reckless endangering first, four counts of possession of a firearm during the commission of a felony, and one count of criminal mischief. I've raised three issues in this brief, but first I'll start with a brief recitation of the facts. I'm sure the court has read the briefs and is familiar with the fact pattern, but some of the facts should be highlighted for the purpose of this argument. It was alleged prior to Mr. McNally's trial that on the evening of January 7th, he drove a vehicle owned by his mother to a residence of the mother of his child and discharged a firearm, presumably in the direction of the home that she was occupying, but hit the home next door four times. He also struck a car and then left the scene. There were no witnesses identifying Mr. McNally at the scene, no witnesses identifying the vehicle he generally operated at the scene. He was developed as a suspect through the testimony of this young lady who bore his child. She indicated that they had a dispute earlier in the day and that they had had physical and verbal confrontations in the past. The police went to the residence where Mr. McNally's mother resided, saw a vehicle, ultimately searched that vehicle. They found shell casings in that vehicle. They found four shell casings at the scene, three in the vehicle. They all appeared to be .45 caliber casings, and at that point Mr. McNally was arrested and charged with these crimes. The shell casings were submitted for analysis to the ballistics expert now employed by the state of Delaware, and he generated an opinion, and at trial Mr. McNally was convicted. There are three issues that I've identified. One concerns the instruction that the jury received. One concerns the testimony of the ballistics expert in that all he basically did was render a conclusory opinion at the trial. And then the last issue concerns the chain of custody of the gunshot residue evidence that was gathered by the police. They swabbed Mr. McNally's hands. They swabbed the interior of the vehicle. This evidence was then shipped to a private lab that conducted an analysis. And with the permission of the court, I'd like to start with the second issue, the ballistics tool mark evidence first. The individual that was called by the state testified that he had 20 years of experience. He identified a number of courses he had attended. And
I take it when you say the individual, you mean the ballistics expert.
Yes, Your Honor, the ballistics expert, excuse me, a gentleman named Carl Rohn, 20 years with an out-of-state police force doing this work and testifying in trials. The expert appeared at the trial, was called to the witness stand, asked a couple of preliminary questions about his credentials, which, in my view, don't warrant a challenge, simply his credentials, and they were not challenged at trial, and then basically blurted out a conclusion that all of the shell casings that were recovered were fired from the same weapon. Now, none of the opinions of the expert were objected to at trial. By trial counsel. I was not trial counsel, but they were not objected to. As the testimony went on, it was clear that there were a number of things omitted that you would generally see in an expert's testimony. For one, other than saying that he looked at these shell casings through a microscope, that expert did not tell the jury what the fundamental science was for ballistics evidence.
This is a Fenster type of argument you're making, is that right?
It's twofold. The Fenster argument is coming, Your Honor, and I'm happy to get to it now. During the course of the expert's testimony, when asked on cross-examination which marks on the shell casings did you rely on to conclude there was an agreement or a match that the expert said he was 100% certain about, he testified that he could not remember which marks he relied on. And he came to court without photographs, without diagrams, without notes. He testified that he was a member of AFTI, and what he actually meant was AFTE, which is the Association of Firearms and Toolmark Experts. And that entity actually has standards that should, and are for the most part across the country, employed in cases like this. And those standards do require an expert who conducts such an analysis to use photographs or diagrams to comprehensively document his findings and to have comprehensive notes if he doesn't have photographs or diagrams so somebody can follow how his analysis proceeded and follow what the basis of his conclusion was. That's not something that Mr. Roan did. And there's another standard that is part of the association's guidance, and that is to make sure that your results are accurate, you want some independent way to reproduce them. And that independent way is to have a second expert go back, check your work, and to see if he comes to the same conclusions, of course, without knowing what your conclusion was. And in that way, you can ensure accuracy in terms of the expert's application of the method of analysis.
Was he cross-examined about those standards?
No, he was not, Your Honor. He was not cross-examined. But he also didn't talk about them. He didn't talk about how or what he did other than to say he looked at these objects through an electron microscope, through a microscope. And I'm not sure why trial counsel didn't explore those things further, but even if he had...
Did he explain the purpose of looking through the microscope?
He explained that he was looking for markings on the shell casings.
For comparison purposes.
For comparison purposes. But what he didn't tell the jury is that, at least as far as his discipline is concerned, that firearms leave unique marks on the shell casings and the bullets that are fired from them that are generally based on the manufacture of the firearm, that the breech plate of the shell, the firing pin, the ejector, the extractor, these mechanical items will leave impressions on a shell casing. And in the view of Mr. Roan and other experts, these markings can then be used to match shell casings in terms of what firearm they were fired from because they're supposed to be unique. But he didn't tell the jury that. He didn't tell the court that in the course of his testimony. He simply stated his conclusion and then couldn't remember how he reached it other than to say he looked at some markings that he thought were in agreement. In fact, he couldn't – the closest he got to fleshing out his opinion at all was to recite all the different things that could leave a mark and saying that I'm sure I looked at marks from all of these things.
So your position – and tell me if I don't have it right – is that after hearing this testimony, the trial judge should have sua sponte had it stricken.
Or the trial judge should have conducted an inquiry to ensure that, first of all, it was a reliable science. Second, that the methods that were employed the way they're supposed to be. And there was some basis for the expert's opinion.
Normally... We deal with situations like this either under a plain error standard or we contemplate whether it could be trial strategy even though you think it was misguided. And to the extent it was misguided, you would deal with that under Rule 61. So how do we deal with this in a direct appeal on the plain error standard?
Well, Your Honor, let's talk about whether it was strategy or not. There was only one piece of evidence linking.
Well, no, I don't. I think the strategy comes in on Rule 61. In a direct appeal on plain error, you have to tell us why, notwithstanding the absence of an objection, reversible error occurred.
In this case, because there was absolutely nothing in terms of testimony at the time of trial that one could follow the expert's use of the science that he is an expert in, the methods that he employed, why they make sense, what the principles are, and how it is that he can say, in this case, I'm 100% certain these shells all came from the same firearm. There's just nothing in the record for the trial judge to, or anyone else for that matter, to follow how he got from point A to point B, how he reached his conclusion. And in that case, it is plain error, and the judge should have stepped in where counsel might have missed his opportunity to object. And the evidence in reading the entire transcript, Mr. Roan did not come to court with diagrams or photographs, did not come to court with a report. There was no report introduced into evidence explaining the methods he employed.
Mr. Howard, are you saying that Rule 702 and or 104 under these circumstances require the trial judge to sua sponte act on behalf of the defendant?
I think the trial judge is the gatekeeper under those rules. And if
does someone have to invoke that function?
Well, you know, expert testimony is a special circumstance, and that is not a new concept. And in a circumstance where the only evidence that linked the defendant to the scene of the crime were these shell casings, the trial judge should have stepped in and asked some fundamental questions. You know, why? You know, you can't tell us what markings you looked at. What about your analysis leads you to conclude they're a match? You know, what is it in your science? And Judge, in this day and age, most firearms are mass produced. So there are some markings that are going to be on shell casings that are going to be consistent for hundreds of firearms. And experts in this industry that are testifying today, most courts require them to identify the subclass of markings on the shell casings of the bullets that might be consistent throughout an entire batch of firearms and separate those from the unique characteristics from a single firearm.
Mr. Howard, let's assume for a moment that you've convinced us all that this could have been handled better than it was, and that this was, in fact, the only evidence that linked your client to the scene and, therefore, to the firing of the weapon. And had the jury not heard the expert say he was 100% certain that it came from the same weapon, that your client would have undoubtedly been acquitted. Now, having convinced us that things could have been handled better, you still have yet to convince us that there is an articulable legal principle that's been violated here that is so fundamental that we should believe that the verdict is, the trial was unfair and that the verdict is unjust. What's the fundamental legal principle? Is it a improper ruling on the evidence? Is it a constitutional violation? What is the fundamental legal error?
There's no improper ruling on the evidence because there was no objection made to the evidence. What I'm suggesting to the court in a circumstance where defense counsel doesn't challenge an expert's testimony, but it is obvious that the expert's testimony should not be permitted at trial, that the trial judge has a duty to step in and...
So the trial judge abused his discretion by not sua sponte preventing the expert without any foundation from offering an opinion that was critical to the outcome of the case.
That's correct.
All right, how about your instruction argument?
The instruction argument. I've restated the instruction or the portion of the instruction I've challenged in my brief. And last time I was here, Justice Holland did a nice job of focusing me on what exactly was my most troubled, what I was most troubled about concerning this instruction. In the last paragraph of the instruction, it says, if, on the other hand, you think there is a real possibility, or in other words, a reasonable doubt that the defendant is not guilty, you must give the defendant the benefit of the doubt and so on. And Justice Holland said to me, Mr. Howard, isn't your complaint the presence of the word not in that sentence? And he's right. It is part of my complaint. If the word not was stricken from that portion of the instruction, then there wouldn't be anything wrong with the instruction. There wouldn't have been any challenge. But as it's presently constituted, it suggests to the jury that they have to have a reasonable doubt that the defendant is not guilty in order to find him not guilty.
Depends on the tone in which it's read, doesn't it? You can read that sentence in a way that it simply explains reasonable doubt, and reasonable doubt having been explained earlier, all read together as a whole, it makes sense.
This portion, Your Honor, I wasn't there when this particular trial judge read this particular instruction on that day.
That's an obvious problem.
But I have been in the courtroom when this particular judge has read this instruction another 5 or 8 times in trials that I've been with him, and I don't remember anything about how it was read that was significant. All I can tell you is that in my last three trials, the language has come out of the instruction. And instead of reading that particular portion of the instruction, what the judges have done is after reading the paragraph about being firmly convinced, they follow with a sentence, if you are not firmly convinced, then you should find the defendant not guilty.
This is a pattern instruction, isn't it?
It's a pattern instruction. Yes, it is.
So we can assume that it's regularly given in this fashion throughout the state.
And I have regularly objected to it, Your Honor, but it is regularly given. That's correct. And in my view, it suggests to the jury that they have to be firmly convinced that the defendant is not guilty in order to find him not guilty. Because the court defines the quantum of proof in the previous paragraph, and they say reasonable doubt. In order to have a reasonable doubt, in order to find the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, you must be firmly convinced. And that's the quantum of proof. So they have to be firmly convinced to find him not guilty. First of all, they don't have to find him not guilty at all. I mean, if the evidence isn't sufficient, he is not guilty.
Well, many of us learned in writing that if you have to say, in other words, you probably shouldn't say anything at all, because you don't add clarity by restating the same point a different way. You run the risk of causing confusion. But if you read that particular sentence to which you object in this fashion, if, on the other hand, you think there is a real possibility, or in other words, a reasonable doubt, that the defendant is not guilty, it's theoretically linked to a real possibility. And in other words, a reasonable doubt is to be read more as a parenthetical phrase than it is a part of the sentence. So it all depends on how it's read, doesn't it?
Your Honor, I agree with you. If there was a comma there or some other indication in the record that that's how it was read, then I probably wouldn't be making this argument, because the instruction might make sense. But I think there's tremendous risk in this particular case that that's not how it was read, and that the jury was left with this.
And that's because of the absence of a comma after reasonable doubt?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's a function of the court reporter, right? Were these written instructions? Were they sent into the jury room?
Judge, I imagine that's the practice at this point.
Well, it's the practice in civil cases. It's not always the practice it didn't always. In my day, it was not always the practice to send them into the jury room in a criminal case, unless it was a very complex case, which this wasn't. So you don't know whether written language without the comma went into the jury room.
But more importantly, Your Honor, I don't think there's any way to safeguard how the instruction was given. If the word not comes out of the instruction, then there is no objection no matter how you read it. But as it's presently constituted.
Or if you take out the additional language, in other words, a reasonable doubt, if that comes out.
I agree, Your Honor. And as I've indicated, I have proposed instructions to trial judges, a modification of this that had been given in my last three trials. And they simply say, if you're not firmly convinced, then you must find the defendant not guilty as the alternative, rather than this, what I think is a very confusing passage.
All right. Again, there was no objection to this instruction, correct?
That's correct. This
so
is a
we
plain
were
error
at
standard.
Plain error again. So what is so fundamentally unfair about this that your client's entitled to a new trial?
Well, if it creates a higher burden or a higher standard of proof for the defendant to be not guilty or found not guilty, then that's a violation of his rights.
Well, if this suggests more of a shift of the burden, isn't it, if it's read the way you...
Yes, Your Honor, and if the jury believes that they have to be firmly convinced that the defendant's not guilty to find him not guilty, then that's a significantly higher threshold for the defense to reach under the circumstances. And that's plain error. It's not an accurate statement of the law. I mean, the defendant can be found not guilty even if everybody in the room thinks he probably did it. Nobody has to be firmly convinced that he didn't do it. The last portion of my brief deals with a chain of custody issue, and I'm not a fan of these issues, but in this particular circumstance, there are some aspects of it that caught my eye, and this was substantially litigated during the course of the trial. The attorney responsible for defending Mr. McNally made a request to the state to produce anybody in the chain of custody for the purposes of trial. And it's clear from the record that the state believed that the only person on the receiving end at the expert lab relevant to the chain of custody was the person they ultimately called to testify. But they found out during the course of voir dire that the gunshot residue evidence, which is gathered by using something akin to a small stub, which is swabbed, so there's a surface on the end of the stub that is swabbed on the hands, and in this case the hands and in the interior compartment of the vehicle. The swab is capped, it's placed in a sealed container, and it's shipped to the lab. At this particular lab, their protocol was for the evidence to be taken out of storage by a lab tech there and opened up, and the actual stubs themselves manipulated into a tray, which was then loaded into an electron microscope so that they could be analyzed. The person who actually exposed the evidence to the lab and handled the evidence with her hands was not called as part of the state's presentation of chain of custody. The objection, the law on this, we have a specific statute for drug evidence. And in the context of drug evidence, the statute is very clear. It says anybody who touches the evidence, it doesn't mean people who touch the packaging, but anybody who actually touches what's going to be analyzed is in the chain of custody. Now, normally, in a drug evidence circumstance, one person opens the package, one person, and the same person does the analysis. So in the drug context, you don't have this issue. There is no codification for other circumstances or other types of evidence. But I would suggest to the court that the guidance from 10 Delaware Code, I think it's 4331, is sound guidance, because gunshot residue evidence is microscopic in nature. And in this case, the trial judge, after extensive argument, accepted, almost as if there was some presumption of regularity, that the person who was not there in the courtroom, who didn't author any part of the report to report what she actually did her job correctly. I think that's what the record suggests. And that's a presumption or assumption that we would suggest the trial court is not permitted to make under the circumstances, where there's a request to produce everybody in the chain of custody, and this person actually manipulates the evidence. Because the risk of adulteration or contamination when you're dealing with microscopic evidence is so high that anybody involved in actually touching the evidence needs to come to court, just like in the instance of drug cases.
Right, so this isn't an issue of we need to examine the chain of custody because this evidence from Mr. McNally's vehicle might have been confused with Mr. Peterson's vehicle. It isn't that kind of confusion.
No, you're
right. There's no argument.
No,
other than it might have been tainted by someone who physically handled it, and we never got the opportunity to cross-examine that person to determine that they handled it properly.
That's correct, Your Honor. And in this case, the testimony at trial was that there were eight stubs used, and that all eight had the evidence of gunshot residue on them after analysis. But what's to say the person who opened and exposed the stubs to the lab and actually manipulated these stubs didn't cross-contaminate the stubs? If for instance, that individual touched the surface of one stub and then inadvertently touched the surface of another stub with the same hand, they could have cross-contaminated the gunshot residue. Because in Mr. McNally's case, not only did they determine it was gunshot residue on his hands, but they determined it was on his car, or in the car that he was known to drive. There were shell casings in the car. Perhaps the firearm had been stored in the car at one point in time. But if there was contamination between the two sets of samples, then that established that Mr. McNally was either near a gun when it went off or fired or discharged the gun close in time to when these samples were taken. And I think the swabbing of his hands took place within 24 hours of the shooting.
You have less than a minute left. Did you want to save it or just finish up?
Well, Your Honor, for the reasons that I've stated, I've suggested that there was error at the trial and that this conviction should be reversed. I have reserved some time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. May it please the court. I'll address the three issues in the order that they're in the brief. all three have been addressed in the opening argument here. The first argument is a plain error argument about the reasonable doubt jury instruction. Last time when we had the panel argument, there was some question about the final paragraph in that it's a five-paragraph instruction. I did have an opportunity to look at the Mills case, and as best I can determine, it looks like the instruction or the last two paragraphs of the instruction that were given in Mr. McNally's case are, if not the same, nearly the same as what was given or what was approved by this court 10 years ago in the Mills decision at page 852. There's also a footnote in Mills that Mills is written by Justice Holland that says the jury instruction that was given in Mills' case has been used by some judges of the Superior Court for approximately 5 years. So I think we're talking about a reasonable doubt instruction that's been used for approximately 15 years, at least by some of the judges in the Superior Court. The difficulty, and I think it was highlighted at the last argument by Justice Holland's question, concerns the use of the word not in that final sentence there. It after it says, or in other words, comma, a reasonable doubt that the defendant is not guilty, comma, you must give the defendant the benefit of that doubt. And the question is whether or not the not should be there. And I think in reflecting on it, it does depend on how the instruction is written. The whole sentence says, if on the other hand you think there's a reasonable possibility, and then it says, or in other words, a reasonable doubt that the defendant is not guilty, you must give the defendant the benefit of that doubt by finding the defendant not guilty. Now, I think while it's certainly not a model of clarity and probably would be improved by some simple declarative sentences, I don't think that's an inaccurate instruction, and it's not plain error in this particular case. The jury was also explicitly told as part of this five-paragraph instruction that was given, quote, the burden of proof is upon the state to prove beyond a reasonable doubt all the facts necessary to establish each and every element of each crime charge. And the jury was further instructed that proof that a defendant is probably guilty is not sufficient. So I think the jury is told what the governing principles are. The instruction here appears to be the same or nearly the same as what's been used in Mills, and apparently that's been used for at least the 10 years ago that Mills was decided, and perhaps 5 years even before that.
Was this specific issue addressed in Mills, or just this instruction was approved for whatever other reason?
I think it was the latter, Your Honor. I don't think this particular issue came up in Mills. I did Mills 10 years ago, and I can't really remember everything, but that was my understanding. And looking at the opinion, that's what it appears to focus on, not this particular question about the not guilty or not. But nonetheless, I do think that how you read it may make a difference, but I don't think it's improper. The Mills instruction that was approved apparently is based on a federal instruction from the Federal Judicial Center, pattern jury instruction number 21 in 1987. That's footnote number 32 in the Mills decision. So I think this is an instruction that's been around for apparently at least since 87 in the federal context of federal pattern jury instructions, and apparently adopted in Delaware for at least 10 and perhaps 15 years by some of the Superior Court judges. Jury instructions have to be reviewed as a whole, with no statement viewed in a vacuum. And reversal is required only if a deficiency in the instruction undermined the ability of the jury to intelligently perform its duty in returning a verdict. Under the circumstances in this case, the jury was not misled in the performance of its duty, and the trial judge's choice of language did not change the burden of proof or distort the accepted meaning of the presumption of innocence here. Therefore, there wasn't any plain error in this particular instruction. Turning to the second argument, it's also a plain error claim about admitting expert opinion on forensic firearm examination. An in-house firearms examiner for the state police by the name of Carl Rohn testified that the seven brass shell casings that have been recovered by the state police were examined by him. There were four brass shell casings found at the scene where the shooting took place in Magnolia, and three other shell casings were discovered inside an SUV that belonged to Mr. McNally's aunt, Mary Jones, and Mary Jones had testified that, yes, Mr. McNally had been driving her vehicle earlier that evening. So that was the connection with the seven brass shell casings. The opinion that Mr. Roan, the forensic firearms examiner, rendered was twofold. One, that the brass shell casings were all 45 caliber, and then second, that they were all fired from the same weapon. Now, the state's position here is that Mr. McNally has not carried his burden of persuasion in demonstrating any plain error. Mr. Roan was certainly qualified to give an expert opinion. He had 20 years prior experience in this field. I believe he had worked for the Philadelphia Police Department as a firearms examiner.
I don't think there's any disagreement that he was qualified.
Right. I think that was certainly fine. And then the question becomes, well, was the trial judge in his gatekeeper function then required to do anything sua sponte before the opinion evidence was rendered? There was no explicit objection from the defense that somehow the judge needed to do the five-step gatekeeper analysis that this court has approved, and the same judge in a earlier decision that I've attached as Exhibit A to the state's answering brief in a case called McElhenney versus Intermatic systematically went through the gatekeeper function that the trial judge has to perform before allowing expert testimony of any nature. So I think it's reasonable to assume that the judge was well aware of his independent gatekeeper function here. The trial judge did not explicitly elucidate on it, but he was not requested to do so either.
Well, as I see it at least, the problem, the gatekeeper problem, is not really where the focus ought to be, because you have a very qualified expert who perhaps the judge has even seen in other cases. There was really nothing, no reason to expect that this expert was going to get on the stand and then say, I've got nothing to support my opinion, and I don't even remember what I saw, but I can tell you that these markings matched. So it's more a question of, it seems, the state being pretty sloppy in terms of knowing that they've got an expert who's beyond question, and then not having the expert actually do, at least on the witness stand, not do the job that he was there for. So isn't it really a question of what the trial judge should have done at the point at which everybody finds out that we've got an expert who's got nothing with him and no support for what his conclusion is?
Well, I think that's certainly the third part of the argument here. There's three arguments that were advanced in the brief, and the third argument, I guess, is whether or not this was a properly based opinion, that what Mr. Roan testified to, and admittedly his testimony is fairly brief, was that he microscopically examined the seven shell casings in April, about 9 months before this trial, and that by using a comparison microscope, as he describes it, he was able to determine that, I guess, these lands and grooves, I think he refers to them as striations, but I'm not positive about that. But anyway, the markings on the shells are similar, and that he's able to match these up. And that's how he's able to reach the conclusion that they're all fired from the same weapon. I don't know if he had to microscopically examine them or not to determine if they were 45 caliber. He may have been able to simply look at those with his naked eye, given his experience and training. But that's what he testified to. he did not have any audiovisual aids. There weren't any blow-ups. There wasn't a written report, although I think that very well may have just been cumulative evidence once he testified to the conclusion. So I think what this really boils down to is a question of the weight of the evidence as opposed to its admissibility.
Well, there's another question there, isn't there? And that is, how does counsel competently cross-examine someone who has no recollection of the basis on which they relied to reach the conclusion that they were nevertheless 100% certain that the markings matched, and it was essential for the markings to match in order for him to reach the conclusion, but he doesn't remember why the markings matched or which ones match as opposed to the others? What do you do if you're defense counsel? How do you carry out your duty of as counsel to cross-examine an expert who stands up and offers, for all intents and purposes, an ipsy-dixit? These shell casings were all fired from the same gun because I know I looked at them sometime in the past, and I know my typical procedure is to look for markings that are similar, and if I find markings that are similar, I reach the conclusion I just reached. But that's it.
Well,
I don't care what his qualifications are. He's got to have some basis for the opinion. He has to be able to explain it with or without charts, which without PowerPoints, he's at least got to give the jury and the judge who admits that opinion some idea of what it's based on. And did he hear?
Well, I think he did. I think what he said was that he looked at these different shell casings under a comparison microscope, and that the striations matched on the shell casings, and that's how he was able to determine they were fired from the same weapon. He didn't elaborate on that. He didn't, you know, have them marked as particular locations and have slides to point out to the jury.
He didn't, like a fingerprint expert, say you have to have 10 similarities or 5 or somewhere between 5 and 10 and show where he found them and why they were matches and explain to the jury how he reached the conclusion that the fingerprints matched. Just didn't happen. Do people just come in and testify, I'm a fingerprint expert? The way I determine whether fingerprints match is to find 5 identical points on each, and if I find 5 identical points, as I did here, then I'm 100% certain that the fingerprints match. End of story. Is that the way it works in our court system?
Well, with the fingerprint evidence, I think it's done the way you initially described it. They'll normally have slides they'll put up, and they'll have the comparison print and whatever was lifted.
And then you
can
quarrel with whether their points actually match or not.
Correct.
You can cross-examine them why you reached the conclusion that they actually match. Why shouldn't it be mandatory for the same situation to happen here, that he say what markings he saw that led him to the conclusion that they were similar, so he could ultimately opine that they were fired from the same gun? Nobody had any idea which marks he found that were similar or why he thought they were similar.
Well, I think he said they were similar because when he looked at them, they were the same. And
but he couldn't remember why.
He couldn't remember
which
marks
were the same as the other ones, right?
That's correct. He couldn't recall 9 months later which ones he found to be of particular significance. But again, I think that goes to the weight of the evidence, not its ultimate admissibility. It was certainly a subject ripe for cross-examination that, well, you can't recall as you sit here which particular marking is it, Mr. Roan, and I think he would have to concede, well, no, I can't. But again, it doesn't make the evidence inadmissible, and it certainly doesn't make it plain error.
Well, Mr. Williams, if I
yes.
could follow up on the earlier questions, setting aside the 702 analysis, under circumstances where this witness essentially said, I can't remember what I did, but I'm 100% certain that they all match, does at that point the trial court have some obligation to assess the credibility of the witness under Rule 104 and intervene, absent objection by counsel?
Well, the trial judge certainly always has a supervisory responsibility, but I think given what was testified to and perhaps a limited basis for the explanation, I looked at them under the comparison microscope and they were the same, or the markings were the same. That's still admissible evidence. Now, the weight of it is what's subject to debate, but I think he was qualified as an expert. That really wasn't contested, and he did do the analysis. It wasn't as complete as an FBI or ATF firearms examiner might do, and the testimony wasn't as complete, but nonetheless, that was what was done before the state police had Mr. Roan. They had to send all of this evidence over to a laboratory in Maryland, and federal officials would come and testify to ballistics evidence. And Mr. Roan was hired to hopefully alleviate some of those problems in having the experts available to appear. He's an in-house person. It is a one-person shop that he's operating here. But again, I don't think that makes the evidence inadmissible. Certainly, if the defense had any contention about any of this, and there were only two things that he said, that it was 45 calibers and they were all fired from the same weapon, that they could have independently had it examined as well.
So I gather your argument is as long as the expert testified as to what he did, even though there may not be any documentation for it, and renders his conclusion, the fact that there's no further detail doesn't render that opinion inadmissible. It just makes it subject to cross-examination. And the fact that there's no cross-examination, at least in this case, didn't create an obligation, a procedural obligation on the part of the trial judge to perform that cross-examination for the defendant. Is that what you're arguing?
Yes, I don't think the trial judge has to step in at that point. The gatekeeper function is earlier on, and I think that was implicitly done in this particular case. So I think here, you know, ultimately what this boils down to is a plain error argument. If you took this evidence out, this ballistics evidence, what else was there in the case? Would a reasonable jury still have convicted Mr. McNally?
That's a different question. Right.
Yes, I know, that's a different question, but that's what all this boils down to. Even if you assume that something was done wrong or Mr. Roan should have had audiovisual aids or whatever, and the other evidence was that Stacy Smith, when she called the 911 center that night, said Troy McNally shot her car. There was also the gunshot residue evidence. There was gunshot residue found on both Mr. McNally's hands and inside his aunt's SUV that he was driving that evening. So if you take this ballistics evidence out, we don't know that these seven shells are all fired from the same weapon, and we don't know they're 45s. There's still sufficient evidence for the jury to have convicted Mr. McNally, and for that reason alone, it's not plain error. The last argument is not a plain error argument. It's an abuse of discretion argument. It's about an evidentiary ruling the trial judge made concerning the chain of custody on the gunshot residue analysis. What occurred here was that samples were taken. There were four from the accused, Mr. McNally's hands, and there were four others from inside this SUV that belonged to Mr. McNally's aunt. They were sent to the R.J. Lee Laboratory, which is a private laboratory in Pennsylvania for testing. The individual who was not present was a lady named Michelle Berry. Michelle Berry's role in all of this was relatively limited. What she did was she physically removed these eight samples from the storage area, placed these vials along with other known control vials on the electron microscope stage, and then she presses the machine's run button. It takes about an hour to process each one of these, and the thing runs overnight. After that was done, the expert who ultimately testified at trial, Lena Foster, she and another scientist in the laboratory also independently examined these same eight samples and determined that there were three chemicals. I think it was antium, barium, and I can't remember what the third one was, but those were present in the eight samples, and the presence of those physical chemicals is indicative of gunshot residue. So that was the basis of what was done. They were independently analyzed even afterwards. The normal standard in all of this is whether there's any possibility of misidentification. There weren't any other samples here that were mixed in. They were just samples from this particular investigation, or if there was any reasonable possibility of some type of adulteration. There's been no indication that there was any evidence of either one in this particular case. And when two different scientists did their own separate examination apart from the electron microscope scanning, they reached the same conclusions here. Under these particular circumstances, the trial judge did not abuse his discretion in allowing the gunshot residue evidence here. And what the gunshot residue evidence indicates is that, at least in terms of the accused, Mr. McNally, there were three possibilities. Because he had gunshot residue on his hands, he either fired a firearm or he was in close proximity to someone else who had fired a firearm, or the third possibility was that somehow or another his hands had come into contact with something that contained gunshot residue, and that's about all you can do with gunshot residue evidence is you confine it to those three possibilities.
Is it correct that the defense asked the names and addresses or asked the state to produce all persons that were in the chain of custody of the gunshot residue evidence?
I think they may have done that, yes.
Did the state produce it?
Well, I think they produced the people they certainly thought were in the chain of custody, and that was just the scientist, Elena Foster, who analyzed it.
That's where I'm heading. This sounds like some of these arguments we get about the state decides whether there's information they have that they have to turn over to the defense or not. Is this an example of the state not responding to a request to know everyone who handled the evidence because the state unilaterally decides that we'll only produce the people that we think are relevant to the case that handled the evidence? Is that where we are with this?
Well, I think this is different than the drug evidence. The drug evidence is a specific statute.
No, forget about that. I'm talking about the Rule 16 relationship between parties.
Mm-hmm.
If, indeed, you request the names, the addresses, or a method of getting in touch with everyone who was part of the chain of custody, does the state unilaterally get to define chain of custody and only produce the people they think would be necessary to the defense? Or should they identify everyone who handles the evidence and let the defense go forward and produce whoever they can or make whatever argument they want to the court about who is essential to develop the chain of custody evidence and who isn't? My concern is that the state seems yet again to be deciding what evidence is admissible rather than putting the defense in a position to raise the issue with the court.
Well, I think in this case they simply didn't know, and if they did, they could make that available and the court could make the decision. Ultimately, it's the court's decision to decide.
How did they not know? When they found out who it was that tested it, didn't they ask the question of the lab, tell us the names of all the people who handle the evidence? Because anyone who handles the evidence is part of the chain of custody. And did they get an answer to that question if they ask it? Or did they just ask, tell us the names of the people who actually will render an opinion on our behalf in the courtroom, and we'll consider them the chain of custody witnesses?
I'm not sure specifically what was asked. I'm assuming they asked to produce the person who analyzed the sample, and that was the
Elena Foster. Is that responsive to the defense request to have identified all persons who were involved in the chain of custody of the evidence?
Well, I guess ultimately it turned out that it wasn't, because there was this other lady, but her job was ministerial in effect. All she did was take the stuff out of storage, put it on the electron microscope scan, and then the trial judge, assuming all that's available, and it was produced at trial, had to make a decision.
It certainly limited the defense's opportunity to inquire about what she actually did. And Mr. Howard says this person exposed seven whatever they are, and one may have had gunshot residue, and all seven may have touched, and they may have tainted. Who knows? But no one will ever know. No one ever knew at this trial because the state didn't bother to turn over the names of the person who handled it and was in a position to taint the evidence, perhaps. We'll just never know.
Well, what we do know from...
Is that the kind of system we have to... We're supposed to be happy about?
Hopefully not, but what Elena Foster testified to is that there's five people in this lab. They've done about 500 of these type of analyses, and that Michelle Berry, the technician who removed this stuff from storage, the eight vials, and placed them on the electron microscope scan stage, she was trained by Elena Foster, and she was told you have to keep these things in this specific order, otherwise things are going to be out of order.
Yeah,
so
I'm concerned like Brady violations or alleged Brady violations. It often comes up that, well, the state decided that that's not Brady material. Therefore, they didn't tell the defense anything about it. When, in fact, the request is encompassing enough that what is questionably Brady material ought to also be identified, and then let the court sort out what is going to be made available to the defense and what isn't. And I'm just concerned that defense attorneys may be relying on a Rule 16 request to get information that's solely in the hands of the state that they think might be relevant to the case, and the state, without neutral intervention by a detached magistrate, is simply determining what's admissible evidence and what isn't. And the defense can go play in the sand. They know nothing new about it, because here comes the trial. They have no idea of knowing who's in the chain of custody.
Well, it was on the record at trial, and the judge did have that, and the judge had discretion at that point whether he was going to exclude it or not. And in this particular case, even if they had excluded that, given the other evidence in the case, I don't think it's a reversible error. There was before the judge, Michelle Berry wasn't there to testify, but the lady who actually did the testing was, and she also testified as to her own independent subsequent chemical analysis.
Okay. Thank you very much. You have 35 seconds, Mr. Howard.
Lucky me. Your Honor, I don't want the court to get the impression that I've abandoned the confrontation argument as to the gun, or as to the ballistics evidence. I mean, in my view, Fenster controls that issue. If the expert doesn't have any idea how or why he reached his conclusion, or if he indicates in this case that I looked at these shell casings and it was a match, and then he's unable to identify what exactly he looked at, because there are different classes of markings, then that's a confrontation issue violation.
Mr. Harrod, your time's
my
up.
My time is up.
We have another argument in 9 minutes, so it's particularly important that we finish on time.
Thank you
very much, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.